its ability to be exchanged is the only reason why it stores value.
Parker Lewis, head of business development at Zaprite, a prolific educator and writer in the Bitcoin space. His series, Gradually Then Suddenly, has helped orange pill many Bitcoiners over the years.
And the more exchange that's available, the more valuable Bitcoin becomes. And that's the logical connection for people, so they don't just sit there thinking, I can sit in my burning home, not go out and create value, not demand Bitcoin as payment, and think that this house isn't going to burn. That dollar inflation is this vicious cycle, and there's no easy solution to it. There's no silver bullet of saying, I'm just going to opt out. When do you cut over? You're assuming, well, there's going to be these rails when I need them. It's like, well, how do they just magically exist at the time when everything's collapsing when you need them?
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Is your water okay?
Believe so.
I think we're winning.
Feels like the energy feels like winning.
The conversation I had yesterday with Courtney, that was one that makes me feel like these tangential parallel movements that we've been talking about for a while are finally going to converge. There was some, we talked about fiat food. And obviously we had Sam from Shirtail Creek Farms in the other week, similar conversation. There is different groups of people philosophically aligned running towards what I would deem to be sort of virtuous end goals, whether it's clean food, education around clean food, getting preservatives out of our food. They're becoming more receptive to Bitcoin, and that's something you're very passionate about. Making sure that these people are accepting Bitcoin as payment so that they can continue to do what they do, whether that's running a farm or educating people about how big pharma, big agriculture, big food is poisoning the lifeblood of our energy, which is the food that we eat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we had Matthew Leshak in to, I think it was the Awesome Bitcoin Club at the beginning of the month, and yeah, he's almost someone that came from it, not directly from the Bitcoin side, but more from the food side, and had talked about how he read the fiat standard right here. And then that chapter just stuck out to him, and he almost didn't believe it was true, that the chapter in fiat standard on fiat food. So then he started doing research, and now he's become this, I don't want to say great advocate, but it's just this champion who's connected it to the money system, who's figured that out. It's like, okay, it's not just that the food's broken, it's that the incentives are tied back actually to the money system. And if you don't fix the money, then you're not going to fix the derivative or higher level problem that, you know, exists not exclusively, but in large part because of the economic incentives. And that, you know, whether it was having Sam through the commons from Shirtail a couple weeks ago, or the interview you did yesterday, of like reinforcing these people, not just that they should accept Bitcoin payments, but the first key being that the problem that they're experiencing it in whatever vertical they're working in or passionate about, in this case, because I kind of put them in two different buckets. One's the healthcare system, one's the food, and those two things are related. But if they're trying to solve a problem, whether it's related to, you know, Sam having a more direct consumer model on the food side, or someone who's looking at the healthcare space and looking at, you know, trying to make America healthy again, if they're not identifying that the money is a big part of the problem, then they're never actually going to be successful in solving it. And so the first step is connecting that Bitcoin isn't just a thing, and that our thing is Bitcoin, and their thing is healthcare. So therefore it's not Bitcoin. It's that money touches everything. And money sits at the root of all these problems to a certain degree, and figuring that out first is a necessary step to actually making progress.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty confident that Courtney had an unlock yesterday during our conversation, particularly pointing to fiat food and describing similarly, but going into more depth than what you just did with Matthew. And it's funny, like somebody is like a nutritionist focused on food and health and the effects of big pharma and big food on the overall well-being of American citizens, particularly. She had no idea the connection, because it was funny. The reason I brought it up, she brought up 1970s, like something happened in the 1970s, and you look at diabetes rates, obesity rates, heart disease rates from 1970. And I was like, well, have you read Fiat Food yet? And she said no. And so I had the opportunity to be like diving into what Safe originally wrote about, Matthew expanded on, which is they had to present to the American public that food prices were low. So they had to subsidize all this cheap crap and do the hedonic adjustments in the CPI to make it seem like your food costs were lower than they actually were if you wanted to buy nutritionally dense, good food. And she had no concept of that monetary effect on what she had dedicated her life to, which is food and nutrition.
Well, yeah. And after the podcast, when we were all talking, it's like, once that idea connects, it's like, well, imagine your food, your money just starts getting worth less and less and less. How do you not have to substitute for worse and worse things? And that the impact of that is wide ranging and pernicious. And then once it unlocks, it becomes obvious. But if that hasn't unlocked and you're looking at a problem like she's looking at and then trying to figure out solutions, but if you have not connected it to the money, just imagine how ineffective you're going to be in actually solving it. If a large part of the problem is because of the debasement of money and value not holding into the future and your whole life functionally being debased without, you know, not only a way out of it, but not basically being able to see half the equation. Like you can only work at a higher order rather than a lower level to solve a problem. And you're functionally just, you just keep swimming upstream and never can actually make a dent.
Yeah. I've got some salt of the earth in my throat I'm trying to work through right now. But
great product, by the way.
Great product. Oh, bring that up after we finish recording. I have something to bring up there. No, but all, it is crazy because getting to the root of the problem, which is the money, because that's what a lot of what we spent our conversation on yesterday was like all the solutions to the health crisis, the obesity epidemic in the U.S. is like throw a pill at it.
And ideally one that someone has to take for the rest of their life.
Yes. And the solving that root cause is like getting good nutrition back into American society and getting good food back in. But again, going back, they're fighting this higher order where it's like we need to pressure Kellogg's to take the food dyes out and make sure we're not poisoning our children. And again, this isn't a knock on anybody. Like you're in your lane, you're focused on what your core competency is. Like the inability to recognize that that is a symptom of the need to flood the market with cheaper goods because you're debasing the money hasn't connected. But once that does connect, and that's something I'm hopeful for, if Trump gets in office and RFK and the MAHA movement get some influence within the administration, is that I like to think that we have enough people within the orbit around some of the decision makers that may come into power to really help them make this connection.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that it does feel like we're starting to stem the tide. You know, just culturally, it feels like majority of people are still in the matrix, but it feels like enough people are out of it and are connecting these dots that it creates the opportunity for real meaningful acceleration of that trend and more people connecting that they're all related and that the money is at the crux of all of it. Because on one side, if you're looking at it and saying a lot of this problem is due to constant debasement of money, which leads to constant debasement of everything around you, that if you also, you know, haven't connected that that's part of the problem, then if you're not solving that part of the problem, you you then can kind of realize, well, I'm never getting out of this. Like if someone, you know, we were having the conversation with Courtney after the podcast yesterday, it's like, hey, if you can't actually save good money, then like how, even if you wanted to like stop replacing, you know, good quality beef with cereal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, if you don't have the savings to do that, you can't do that. So that you actually, and it doesn't just make it magically easy to do, but unless you take that step to start being able to actually be able to afford things, and then like, well, how do you afford things if everything constantly gets more and more expensive because they keep printing money and debasing it? Then you're like, okay, well, if we actually want to solve this, it's not just kind of educating about, you know, oh, this is the problem, but actually giving somebody a viable way to fix it. And if they're not saving in a form of money that preserves their value over time, they're functionally not in a position to do that. It's just, you're just still in a hopeless position, knowing that there's a problem without a tangible solution to actually better people's lives.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, sort of flung this on you, but I think it's important to rehash the multiple conversations we've had over the last couple of weeks with people that we think should get Bitcoin, because it highlights the order of operations to ultimately what we're going to talk about, which is your piece, Bitcoin's exchange theory of value and the importance of accepting Bitcoin as payment. The order of operations, people first have to recognize this problem and identify Bitcoin as a solution. Only after that point can they begin to do the research and really orient their business and their personal finances in a way that allows them to protect themselves against this debasement that we're describing here.
Right. Or their cause, if it's, you know, in the case of Courtney working on this like broader effort to really change how people think about health and make a dent in that, or, you know, Sam, you know, building Shirt Tail, the farm, and then Local Pastures, the distribution grocery store, to get, you know, product directly from the farm to the consumer, to say, you know, I you know, first understand the problem, second understand the solution, and then being able to operationalize the solution to advance either a business or a cause, an initiative. And you know, ultimately what got me, not just to, you know, talk about, you know, why I wrote the piece, but just focusing on Bitcoin payments period, is, yeah, and we had a conversation about this, I think, on the podcast probably a year and a half ago after this slew of bank failures. So like thinking about, you know, pausing from the idea of just, you know, the consequences of monetary debasement on all aspects of life, but just when your bank is at risk of failure, and that, and what was happening, you know, and with a series of those, saying what would we build if, you know, reliable access to our banks didn't exist. That's what really set me down the journey of Bitcoin payments in the first place. But then beyond that, you know, when we think about Bitcoin as part of a solution, which, you know, to your question, it's like, yes, we all recognize that Bitcoin stores value, but until, it's like, we're never actually going to get to the other side of the problem if the system isn't working independent of all other systems, right? And a key part of that is being able to interact directly from an economic perspective and exchanging value. And, you know, I think if there's an area of Bitcoin that's most underdeveloped, it is the payment side, but it is, you know, key to whether, you know, it's a farmer building a local grocery store and saying, okay, I'm recognizing that the fiat currency is a problem. Well, if the fiat currency is the problem and Bitcoin's part of the solution, then being able to take Bitcoin directly from my customers is very logically part of the solution. And that same type of thought process extends out to virtually everyone that's looking to, or how they should be thinking about Bitcoin and looking at it as an aggregate solution to this problem.
Is it fair to say to you that you think there's been an over-index on viewing Bitcoin solely as a store of value?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, but not because that's a problem in itself, but just like helping people understand. And Roy from Breeze wrote a great article yesterday, kind of taking a different approach to explaining a similar concept, but recognizing that Bitcoin's only able to store value because it's easily exchangeable. And, you know, if I'm helping somebody understand Bitcoin from zero to one, I'll oftentimes focus on a very simple concept, like it's got a fixed supply, money can't be printed, and money that can't be printed is going to store value better than money that can be easily printed. And that's a really easy concept for somebody to get, especially if they're first starting down the path to understanding Bitcoin. But if you go a layer deeper, it's that money's function to store value is necessarily tied to between a series of exchanges. It actually doesn't have a purpose if there's not an exchange on the front end where you begin to store value, and then an exchange on the back end where you realize that value. It's really important that whatever you're storing your value in maintains its purchasing power between those series of exchanges. But if it weren't exchangeable on the other side, then it will not store value. So thinking about Bitcoin's fixed supply in a vacuum, like I'm just going to sit here and save it forever and that's how I'm deriving value of it, is just misunderstanding the function of money. And part of what I explain in the piece is that at a fundamental level, at a very logical level, Bitcoin does not increase in value merely by you being willing to buy and save it. Because every time you buy, someone is exchanging value to you. You're transferring some value, even if it's dollars, as an indirect intermediary. And that the consequence of that is that anybody using Bitcoin, they're ascribing value to it for what they're able to exchange in the future, even if they're not intending to do it for the future or long into the future. And the more easily Bitcoin is exchangeable, the more value it will garner. But it actually garners the value, or it increases in value, because this is what I explain in the piece, that trade is not zero sum. That this would be a turtles all the way down problem if there wasn't mutual benefit to two parties to a trade, because that's actually how value is created, through the division of labor and through specialization. And so I wrote the piece, and part of the reason why I'm focused on Bitcoin payments is because it's a critical aspect of Bitcoin's ability to store value. And if you're just thinking of it in a vacuum, like it's just a store of value and not a medium of exchange, you're not actually understanding.
What's up, freaks? This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is here building the Bitcoin bank of the future. It starts with their Vault product, a 2 of 3 collaborative custody vault, which allows you to hold two keys. Unchained holds one. On top of this, they're building incredible products. They're trading products. You want to buy and sell Bitcoin, you can do it through their trading desk. If you buy Bitcoin directly into cold storage, if you don't want to sell your Bitcoin, you can borrow against your Bitcoin with their lending desk. They have an IRA product, which they recently dropped the price down to 21 cents. So if you want to roll your IRA from traditional assets into Bitcoin, Unchained makes that extremely easy. You're able to hold your own keys. Again, it's the bank of the future. Go to unchained.com. Use the code TFTC when you check out for any of their products. You'll get $50 off. Check out their concierge onboarding if you're looking to do it the right way. Unchained.com. Use the code TFTC. Yeah. Now let's dive further into these exchanges not being zero sum. Because you describe it well in the piece, and I think it's really important for people, particularly like laymen who aren't fully versed in Austrian economics and just economics more generally, and who want to understand this from first principles, like why is it not zero sum? Like what, like particularly exchanging money to build capital to provide value to the rest of the world that is net positive.
So think about, there are a couple ideas, and I'll kind of jump not necessarily to the end of the piece, but kind of towards the end of an idea in one of the early sections, where it's like, think about Bitcoin and its fixed supply. Perfectly fixed, terminal state, no more Bitcoin, no less Bitcoin. 100% of all Bitcoin is being saved by somebody at all times. And then think about what's functionally happening in that economic system. Money is moving between individual to individual, business to business, individual to business. And the actual exchange of money is being used to build more and more things. More and more goods exist, more cars exist, more homes exist, more humans exist as humans procreate and build things. And then think about this fixed money supply distributed across more goods and services rather than less. That is actually the function by which the monetary unit increases in value. Constant nominal amount of currency and more goods, and the purchasing power of each nominal currency unit buys more for that reason. But it's actually the money that's coordinating the trade that's actually allowing for more goods to exist. That's the inherent function of money. And so one of the examples that I use in the piece is thinking about Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs used money to pay a bunch of employees and to pay manufacturers, suppliers to build an iPhone. And the iPhone is capital. That's the accumulation of capital. Now everybody walking on the planet, or virtually everyone, can have the benefit of an iPhone. So each individual trade, if I was to think about Jobs paying an individual money to do a service in this, you know, very complex process to produce an iPhone, the person who got the money benefited, and Steve Jobs mutually benefited. And then everybody else who bought the product benefited as well. But the value creation happens through those series of individual trades that ultimately allow people to build goods and services that didn't previously exist. And through that process is how the underlying value of the unit increases, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense, to me at least. But I hope anybody listening, like, just understanding the process by which value is created and brought to the world. I think an iPhone is a perfect example. Not only is Apple benefited massively, $1 trillion company, but individuals who own iPhones have added more value to the, you know, the world just by having the accessibility of an iPhone. Like, we can build apps. Like, if you wanted to, you can access the internet and be more productive on the go. And so overall, productivity is certainly increased due to this one simple product. And that product was the product of economic exchange, exchanging value via money to coordinate all that activity to produce that end product.
Yeah. And so, like, kind of like using a different example, which would be, it's like, if you think about every exchange, it's like there's two core concepts. It's that one, the utility of money is to coordinate trade and economic activity. And that is actually what allows for division of labor, specialization, and gains from both of those, division of labor and specialization. And that this fundamental idea that trade is not zero sum. And what that doesn't mean is that certain trades can't be, like, some trades can be zero sum, and some trades can, you know, not intend to be zero sum, but an entrepreneur can speculate and trying to build a new product or service and it not being valued by the market. And in that case, it's not zero sum, but the basis of trade and the reason why trade persists is because there's mutual benefit. And so whether it's an individual working at a company, the company's getting a benefit because that individual is performing a role, and then the individual gets paid in money, and then they benefit from future optionality, saying, I can go to the market and take this money and facilitate more trades. Or a producer of goods is buying some input to a capital good, and their suppliers benefiting from the optionality of money, and they're getting the good in return to then build a high, you know, a good that's further down the production to, say, build a car, right? They bought a chassis from a company that, you know, supplies chassis to GM, and GM ultimately builds the car, and everyone along those series of exchanges benefits. And, you know, the similar thing would be in the context of an oil well. You know, there's a guy working on an oil rig right now, and he's getting paid money, and now he has the future optionality of that money, and the company that he's working for has the future purchasing power of oil that's coming out of the ground. But fundamental to all of those is that each party to the trade benefits mutually for different reasons. And when you add it up, that's actually what creates value in the economic system. And the reason why I tied this into Bitcoin is to help people understand that if they're just sitting there on their laurels, staring at their Bitcoin, like, that's not actually how value gets created in the world. And that's actually not how value gets created in Bitcoin. That's not why the price of Bitcoin goes up on their screen. The value of Bitcoin goes up on the screen, obviously in part because people are learning about Bitcoin, understanding why it stores purchasing power. But at a more fundamental level is because people are going to be able to use that medium to facilitate a series of exchanges, ultimately to deliver value to other people. And the more of that that's happening, the more valuable Bitcoin will become, because that is the purpose of money. And it will also logically trend towards direct commerce, because that's the most efficient form of trade.
Well, yes. And I think it's important to highlight, like, the complex process which we just walked through becomes harder and harder as your money gets debased. This coordination and these transactions of mutual benefit in a currency that is increasingly and ever faster becoming debased at some point, like, it's not mutual because use extreme examples, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, like, people would get paid and they'd have to go spend it right away. And the person they were exchanging those bolivars or Zimbabwe notes with were the people that ended up with them, like, actually got the shit end of the stick, because unless they could turn around and spend it immediately as well, like, that was arguably like a bad trade-off for them.
Right. And so, you know, kind of addressing something on the Bitcoin side, someone might say, well, if I give you my Bitcoin and then it goes up massively in value, then didn't I get a worse deal from that trade? And the answer is, it's like, if you are spending any form of money, like, if you're spending dollars, it's theoretically at the opportunity cost of not owning Bitcoin. So it doesn't actually change the calculus. And yes, anybody who is endeavoring, say, to invest, if you are spending for investment purposes, you should ideally be thinking about it in Bitcoin terms and to say, hey, well, if I'm going to exchange this Bitcoin to go try to build this product, you should have the intention of only doing that if you expect you can get more Bitcoin. Over time, what happens when money is storing its value in this end state is that money is actually storing its value rather than losing its value. And you bring up a really important point, which is, and this is something that I do not think that people appreciate, because they think, well, I'm just going to save in Bitcoin and spend my dollars. But as the dollar gets increasingly volatile relative to goods and services and loses more of its value more quickly, it actually makes the process of trade and exchange harder. And a great example of that, which is, you know, for, you know, people should go listen to the podcast that you and Sam Moffitt recorded from ShirtTale. He talked about having to look at his business basically after the fact, realize what his costs had actually gone up, and then basically like a year or two later, then increase prices. He's constantly having to reevaluate his business model because the money supply is changing, not just because his market is changing independent of that fact. And that itself creates friction to trade. And that as this continues to go on, that what's really happening is what inflation is, it is money printing. But what hyperinflation is as an extension of that is not just because they printed too much money and the money became worthless. It's that the degradation of the money and the debasement of the money actually made trade harder to coordinate. As that happens, certain businesses fail and goods actually start to become scarce relative to the amount of money. It's not a constant amount of goods and services and more money existing. It's that the more and more money existing is actually what causes the goods to become scarce, because a business model breaks. A business keeps raising their prices until they price their customers out, and then their customers stop showing up. And they can't continue to service the other ones because their business has now become unprofitable. And in that sense, as fiat currency loses its value increasingly, it becomes less and less mutual. If I'm saving in Bitcoin, I spend a small portion of it and the rest of my Bitcoin gets worth a lot more, that was still a mutually beneficial trade, especially if I was a consumer buying something like steak that I needed to survive till the next day. But this broader point of, you can't just sit, and I think about that, you know, the dog sitting in the house on fire saying everything is fine. That's what I think is actually most relatable to this idea that I'm going to store value in Bitcoin and never spend it and think that that's just going to continue to go on, because there's a real consequence to you taking a bad form of money directly and it losing purchasing power until you can ultimately get into the good form of money. And the way to solve that for all parties is just to transact in the good form of money and to be exposed as less and less to the bad form of money.
Yeah, it's either the "this is fine" meme or congratulations, you played yourself, because the mindset of I'm just going to sit on my Bitcoin and spend dollars, not recognizing that spending those dollars with people that provide you goods and services that make your quality of life possible does not put them in a good position to continue to provide that good or service into the future.
You're functionally just externally, what you're doing is you're externalizing the cost of the fiat system onto the business owner that you supposedly depend value. On.
Yeah.
Right. And so in one of the prior pieces I had written, I explained that if you don't actually value the service and you don't want it to be around, maybe it's not rational to spend Bitcoin. But if we value Sam and Shirtail and Local Pastures, and we know that he's going to be better off if he has Bitcoin, and collectively, all of us, if we can cut out the fiat system, and that's going to be important to the future viability of our ability to exchange value with our local grocer, who's also our local rancher, then it becomes very rational. And that if you're just sitting there, because there's this logical dilemma for the scenario where it's, I'm just going to save in Bitcoin and spend in dollars. It's either you're holding a lot more dollars than maybe you should be, or, well, when does that change? When does inflation get so bad, and not just bad in degree, but the speed at which prices change? Because that's actually what happens in hyperinflation. When do you cut over? Like, it's almost, you're assuming, well, there's going to be these rails when I need them. It's like, well, how do they just magically exist at the time when everything's collapsing when you need them? The reality is it happens because there's already a mutual incentive to pursue it, even with, say, the friction of the tax system. And for people that are high agency to realize, well, I can't just go from today to this future state where everything's working if something's not making it work along the way progressively. And that it's not actually consistent with reality to say, like, I'm just going to sit in this burning home where, you know, inflation's getting worse and worse, price changes are getting more and more frequent, more economic imbalance exists rather than less, more censorship in the financial system exists rather than less, and the Fed's lowering interest rates and they're about to have to print money. This house on fire is only going to be further engulfed in flames. So if somebody's not high agency, then and what will ultimately happen for maybe most people is certain people are high agency, and those people will benefit because of the people that were
complacent.
You know, yeah, the people that are complacent will benefit because other people who are higher agency say, like, okay, I'm not going to wait till I can't escape the burning house. I'm going to go ahead and help create a solution.
This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt, with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff. Yeah. And that's, so I think what we're, I mean, this is something we talk a lot about, just not in the context of payments, but like timing. And obviously merchant adoption was a big meme back in like the 2013-2014 era, like Roger Ver, Bitcoin Jesus. It's part of the reason why he forked off, because he didn't think Bitcoin as a medium of exchange at the protocol level was being prioritized enough. Didn't think like solutions like Lightning, but it, arguably at the time, 2013-2014, the market wasn't ready for merchant adoption. Bitcoin was a fraction of the market cap that it is now. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Like, how do we know when the timing is right? Like, is inflation increasing at a pace where you think it is wholly necessary at this point in time to begin adopting the rails just for redundancy's sake, whether that's because you want to have the rails available to accept the better money to protect yourself from debasement, or have the better rails to protect yourself from a banking crisis, which gives you creates an inaccessibility to your money. Both.
And no one can know, no one can time anything perfect, or no one has perfect knowledge to say is now the right time. There's a few things that I look at to at least think conceptually about it, which is multiple $200 billion banks failed practically, you know, one of them failed practically overnight, the other one failed over a matter of a couple of weeks. And those were the third and fourth largest bank failures ever in the United States. So the system is still just as fragile as it was in 2008, as it established that it was in 2020, and again demonstrated in 2023. Another thing is that, yeah, Bitcoin is, you know, at equilibrium now, storing over $1 trillion of purchasing power. And I believe you guys at TFTC put out, I think people can think about these different ways, but that Bitcoin's this somewhere between the fifth and 10th largest currency system in the world.
Base money. Yeah.
Base money. But base money is relevant. If Bitcoin's at the very inception of another adoption wave, if adoption increases by from here at an equilibrium of 1 to 1.5 trillion, if adoption increases by 5 to 10 times, then that's 5 to 10 trillion. That not only represents purchasing power that that merchants become interested in to say, okay, I can sell to that market, or I want to sell to that value. It's also that value is an output of enough people valuing Bitcoin that there's enough potential density to begin to drive a trading economy, right? And again, that is difficult to forecast of like, when is enough density enough? But as there's greater density, there's greater opportunities to trade and exchange. Just by definition, as there's more people holding Bitcoin, there's more buyers and sellers.
There's more
consumers and businesses that you
can connect with.
Too. Yes. Yeah. And so just thinking about the size of where Bitcoin is today, a trillion versus a billion between a billion and 5 billion in 2016, you know, when that might have been, and saying that it's 100 to 1,000 times larger, right? But then also, again, if you recognize that, if you've recognized that the fiat currency is a risk to you from a balance sheet perspective, from this store of value quote aspect, then it should become logical. Maybe the danger to you does not seem as clear and present, but if that currency is a risk, then the rails of the currency are logically also a risk. And that it's one of those, if not us, then who? If not me, then who? If now, then when? Right? And because there's so much negative asymmetry at a system level and at a business level that it's logical and instinctual to protect yourself against a risk of ruin. To say, like, I can't wait until I absolutely have to have this new rail to then begin thinking about building it. And that the more high agency people there are that think that way, the less pain there will actually be. And so, you know, and then it does, you know, it's always re-anchored back to this fundamental to help people understand, which is storing value to what end, right? It only exists if its ability, in its ability to be exchanged at some future date, even if you never intend to spend it. The value of Bitcoin is dependent on your future optionality to spend. And the more of that that exists, the more valuable the currency unit is to you. If you had Bitcoin and you could only sell it at one place, if you could only exchange it with one party, how valuable would Bitcoin be? If you could only exchange it at five places, if you could only exchange it for 10 places, if you could only exchange it for fiat currency and you were dependent on those centralized sources, what's the value cap of Bitcoin? If you're able to spend it at every merchant around your local economy, just the sheer number of people that are willing to bid for your Bitcoin, the more optionality you have, it should be logical. Oh, the underlying medium is actually more valuable to me, the more places, not less, than I can spend it. And that only happens, and again, I think about this very logically. It's like somebody's not going to accept Bitcoin as payment, nor do I think they should be accepting Bitcoin as payment or even using Bitcoin as medium of exchange if they don't first understand why Bitcoin stores value. At that same time, its ability to be exchanged is the only reason why it stores value. And the more exchange that's available, the more valuable Bitcoin becomes. And that's the logical connection for people, so they don't just sit there thinking, I can sit in my burning home, not go out and create value, not demand Bitcoin as payment, and think that this house isn't going to burn.
Yeah. And through your work, I mean, what are you guys seeing in Zaprite? Like, what is the typical archetype of your customer, somebody who's recognized this? Or is it newer, older? But obviously, we use Zaprite to invoice everything we do here at TFTC. I mean, I made the logical decision to run my business on a Bitcoin standard 7 years ago. In terms of like new Zaprite customers, what are some of the different archetypes?
So, I mean, we focus the product and what we're actually building specifically, and, you know, in part how we market it, but also how we build it specifically to people who already understand Bitcoin. So really there's two archetypes, but they have one thing in common. The two archetypes are Bitcoin is core to their business. They work in Bitcoin mining. They run a Bitcoin podcast. They host a Bitcoin event or conference or first something core. Bitcoin is central to it. So that's one archetype. The other archetype is just a small to medium-sized business that's generally privately owned that has one or two key decision makers that understands Bitcoin and understands why Bitcoin is important and understands why they need to make an investment in infrastructure to be able to diversify and be able to make for their customers that want to pay them in Bitcoin, make that available, basically reducing a risk from their business. The thing that is common across both of those archetypes is people that understand Bitcoin. What I find is if I'm talking to somebody that's having to be explained the benefit of Bitcoin at the same time that they're trying to understand, should I accept this as money, as payment directly? It's ultimately a waste of time for both parties. It's like, hey, go read a book, go read the Bitcoin standard, go read Gradual Then Suddenly, you know, Broken Money. But more and more people that are just sole proprietors or, you know, like Sam is taking Bitcoin on his online store. We're working on, you know, trying to convince him to do that in person. Obviously, we need the tools to be able to do that. Local dentists just set up a local orthodontist, bike shops. So it very much is that small business where once the idea of Bitcoin unlocks for somebody, the business owner can take the forward action to implement that. obviously it's a lot more difficult. The larger a business is, the more stakeholders there are to gain a consensus to then, and then it's also oftentimes more expensive to them to be able to implement something because there's a lot more red tape, a lot more approval processes that things need to go through. But it is just normal people who understand how difficult running a business is and understanding how much more difficult running a business is when what you're being paid in constantly gets destroyed. And so we're really focusing on the early use cases where it's either a core, you know, common, there's Bitcoiners willing to pay, and there's a lot of, you know, where Bitcoin is core to someone's business. But then also for the people that, that Bitcoin isn't core to their business, they're basically saying, okay, I understand this medium Bitcoin. I understand why if I don't take this step, I'm going to have to at some point in the future, and I can use it as a strategy advantage now and today by attracting Bitcoiners to my business. And even if they don't pay me in Bitcoin, the fact that I accept it is a advantage over my competition. It's a way for me to find customers. And so those are really the two archetypes that, that we're, you know, targeting the product toward and are the people that are coming in most commonly.
Yeah, and for that small to medium business that isn't core to Bitcoin, I know that you talk to a lot of your customers every day. Like, does that redundancy give them peace of mind? Like, even if people aren't spending Bitcoin with them?
I don't think it's so much peace of mind. I think that it is always twofold. It's, I'm doing this to eliminate a cost. And so on that side, it's part peace of mind, but it's more, again, that high agency, like I'm solving a problem, you know? If a business owner identifies a problem in their business, they don't necessarily just fix it for peace of mind. It's like, okay, I fixed that problem. Now I can move on to the next problem. I can know that piece is solved. And so I don't necessarily think of problem solving as just peace of mind. And then it's forward action of saying, okay, now that I have this, I want to turn it into an asset. I want to make this known to my customers, make it known why I'm doing this, why it's important to me, and why they should come work with someone that's values aligned in, you know, and that's, you know, very logically other Bitcoiners. So, you know, peace of mind, I said, is only one component, but they want to actually then get value beyond that. And so it's kind of leveraging it, not just as a cost center, but to, you know, take ground.
Yeah. And I don't want to say you partly answered, but I was going to ask next, like, what do you think needs more attention, the actual tools to facilitate these payments or the education around why people should leverage these tools in the first place? And you mentioned something that reminded me of our former doctor. She retired, but that's one thing I really appreciate. Like, she used ZapRite. I paid her in Bitcoin, but she did have this section on her website, which is like, we accept Bitcoin, and explained why she accepted Bitcoin. Like, she was values aligned with sound open source money, and that alone, by her accepting Bitcoin and having to explain why, because people could see it at checkout, like, you just see it and there's no explanation. It's like, why am I doing this as a business owner? Some, Veronica particularly, felt compelled to explain why, and that's in and of itself like an education touch point for people who are not aware of Bitcoin. But still the broader question, like, what needs more attention right now? Education around why, or why you should use the tools, or attention on making the tools as seamless and easy to use as possible.
So they each relate to the other, which is the tools have to exist in order for, and they have to be easy to use in order for someone to have the opportunity to be educated on why they're important to then adopt them. But then the more that people adopt them, the better the tools become, and the more resources you have to go out and educate more people on why they're important. And so I think that on the front side, it is delivering the actual tool that for a sufficient number of merchants to be able to adopt is necessary. But beyond there, it does then the first step is educating the merchants, the Bitcoin holders, saying, if you are a business owner, you should invest in this for your business, and you should open up this avenue for your customers, and that will benefit your business on a range of levels. That next step, which we do encourage business owners to do, is to make it known that you're accepting Bitcoin. And not just that, but why? Because in Veronica's case, it was, she valued sovereignty, she understood Bitcoin, and she wanted to tap and attract local patients here in Austin that were values aligned. Her service was open to a broad-based people, but it became a, not just like a marketing channel and like, how do I go, you know, acquire customers on the internet, but okay, this is what my service is. How do I find people that actually value what I'm delivering to the market? These Bitcoiners seem to value the service I'm delivering. If I do this, that will be a signal in itself. And if I tell them why, then I'm more likely to attract more of them. And you can say that, you know, I don't want to say she's unique, but she's somebody that's very sovereignty minded, and Bitcoin resonated with her very well. But anybody that's figured out why Bitcoin is a better form of money and is recognized, like, as I'm talking about as a business owner, that why the fiat currency is a problem, and they open up their business. We have, you know, like thinking about a dentist in Michigan saying, hey, all my customers, you can pay me if you want. And if you're in this local area, come to me if you're a Bitcoiner. It's a way to signal and communicate that your values aligned. And the more that people know that you're accepting Bitcoin because you understand Bitcoin and that you're saving in Bitcoin, that is also a necessary, I would say necessary, it is a piece that is important to getting people to actually pay you in Bitcoin. Because if you accept Bitcoin and you're immediately converting it to dollars and everyone knows it and they know that you're not actually values aligned, why would they do that if they have dollars? They'll just spend the dollars there. And that's not in every case, but it's a two-sided equation. It's like the tools exist. The merchants have to be educated why this is important. So those people that are sitting in the burning house will say, okay, I'm a Bitcoiner. I understand Bitcoin. I run a business. Me not doing this is actually low agency. If I do this, and if I invest in this side of my business, I can then go market and acquire Bitcoiners around me. There'll be a lot of benefits that come from that. And then as that happens, like if the rails exist and no one uses them, the rails will not get better, or the rails just won't exist. And so there do have to be, and we think this is very much a merchant led, you know, two side of the equation, which is like, it's not consumers saying, I want to pay in Bitcoin. It's people that run businesses that understand the benefits of Bitcoin, understands the risk of fiat rails, and say, you know, I'm going to build this into my business before I have to, and then turn it to an advantage. But in order to turn it to my advantage, I need to educate my customers, because that was core to maybe why I decided to do this in the first place, because I was educated. So it becomes logical to extend that education.
Yeah. And it's the converse of what we talked about earlier, which is, again, you don't want to be the congratulations, you played yourself meme, like holding your Bitcoin and not supporting the business owners that you depend on for the goods and services you use throughout your life. Conversely, the business owner wants to attract the Bitcoiner because they want that customer that actually has good money, has money to spend, and actually preserves value to sell their goods and services. So it is this symbiotic.
It's a very symbiotic relationship. I gave a presentation a few weeks ago talking about the various different benefits. And that, I think, is one of the, again, it is hard to appreciate if you are sitting there looking at the world saying, I'm going to just store value in the Bitcoin and I'll deal with fiats as a rail, not realizing that the fiat system and the rails of that are a risk. That if you are not more like this, this seems like a tail event. The reality is it's an inevitability. So you might say, well, it's not going to happen for 2 decades. I'd say it probably happens in this decade. But even if I'm wrong, is there some reason why you wouldn't benefit from the same logic? And that logic is, well, and I use this cartoon, not to make light of what's happening in Venezuela, but there's this cartoon where a guy shows up with a wheelbarrow of dollars and Maduro's, or Bolivar's, I guess, and Maduro sitting at a in a shack with several rolls of toilet paper, and the guy shows up with a wheelbarrow of full of cash and then walks away with one roll of toilet paper. That if your customers, and if you're not catering your customers to people who hold Bitcoin, so if your business is highly catered to people that only have fiat currency, as you need to increase prices, if I think about Sam in Local Pastures, as he increases the price of eggs, it, at a certain point, people that only have fiat get tapped out by fiat price increases. And that's ultimately how your business gets impaired, because your revenue either goes down because you lose customers, you've increased price, which means that fewer and fewer customers are sharing more and more of the burden, or you're constantly having to invest marketing costs to acquire more customers. So it's kind of like running on a treadmill. But one thing happens for certain: as you continue to increase prices, somebody, one of your customers says, I can't keep paying this. I'm going to downgrade my life to some shittier
factory eggs.
Yeah. And that by catering your business to people whose money is storing purchasing power, and you know, continues this example, is like, hey, when the egg price increases happen, if I can actually purchase more eggs despite the dollar price increase because my Bitcoin has saved value and I'm saving the majority of my value, I can continue to be a customer. That's right. I don't actually have to degrade my lifestyle. I can sustain the dollar price increases because my Bitcoin's purchasing power continues to go up despite that fact. Well, put yourself on the other side of that equation, which is the business owner. If you don't have customers like that, eventually your customers start showing up. Your customers can no longer be your customers. And if somebody's looking at that equation saying, like, what's the likelihood of that happening? It's that is happening every single day, like right now. And because as food at the grocery store costs 50% more than it did 4 years ago, they still have to keep buying food. So they might not only have to substitute, you know, one quality of food for a lower quality food, but they're cutting something else out of their life. So it's like, even if you're not raising prices, somebody else is, and they might have to turn your service off because they can no longer sustain it. And that is happening every single day right now. Today, we see videos of it all the time. And the faster or the sooner that someone says, I'm open for business with Bitcoin, I get it, I know why I need to value you, I know why I need to cater to you, you can pay me in the money that you hold, and I actually prefer that. And if you pay me in that, I actually have a better chance of continuing to be able to deliver this service that you value. There's the mutual benefit. There's how Bitcoin's actually creating value. The more exchange is helping to facilitate, the more value you actually get from the remaining 99.9% of your Bitcoin that you didn't spend on that individual transaction.
Yeah, and let's dive into one of the marketing tactics that we've been talking about the last few weeks, which is publicly positioning your products in a Bitcoin per unit and tracking that and articulating that to the market.
Yeah, call it a marketing tactic, strategy, just something that is logical for, if you're a business owner, as an example, and you follow this logic that as you increase prices, you're ultimately pricing somebody out. You're impairing your business because you're now having to recreate a customer from that person that gets priced out. And if you keep doing this and you're only tailoring your business to customers that have fiat, or you're not actively trying to get customers that have sound money, whether they pay you in Bitcoin or not, you're going to face this dilemma. And that what really matters, and this is where, you know, it's like, clearly the dollar is still the unit of account. Clearly the dollar is the primary reserve asset. However, as more people hold Bitcoin reserve, and Bitcoin will become the primary reserve asset for the reason that it will become the primary medium of exchange in the unit of account. But if you are saving in Bitcoin, and because Bitcoin increases in purchasing power for the reason that it has a fixed supply and more people are adopting it for all of those collective benefits, then your unit of account is really Bitcoin. And so even if you're not tracking things in your daily life, like think about like what it means to be a unit of account. Humans do hundreds, if not thousands, of economic calculations in their head that they don't, that they might even be conscious of on a daily basis. That's all still done in dollars. But there's a moment where you're thinking about something, maybe like a house that you're going to buy, and you say, how much does that cost in Bitcoin? And what percentage of my Bitcoin is that house? You're starting to price things in Bitcoin. Well, because they keep printing dollars, and because people continue to increase prices in dollars because their input costs are going up, that the way that I think it becomes logical to measure your own effectiveness as a business is to start to think about your dollar price increases in Bitcoin terms. And so again, translating this to a finite surface area so someone can understand what I'm talking about, it is, I did this analysis, which was looking at the eggs at the local farmers market going from 8 to 875.
This is a great example of congratulations, you played yourself on the Fed's part.
Yes. And
we'll explain that and then
in,
dive into
well,
this.
Yeah. Well, in this, I'll explain that now. 6 years ago, the price of Bitcoin was dropping from its astronomical rise. I would say it was correcting from 20,000 down to 3,000 or 4,000. And the Fed wanted to dunk on Bitcoin and said, hey, look, the price of eggs are going up in Bitcoin terms. And so they wrote a blog, and realistically it was about volatility, but they were making this point that the cost of eggs was going up in Bitcoin terms drastically. And then if you extend that, and the blog is still up, and they have a chart now that is like a Fred chart, St. Louis Fed produced, that is the cost of eggs in dollars side by side with cost of eggs in Bitcoin. And you can see that the cost of eggs national average in dollars has gone from $1.47 to $3.81 a dozen, an increase in dollar terms of 160%. But from that low of 2018, when the Fed put out the piece to highlight that the price was increasing in Bitcoin terms, over time, for fundamental reasons, the price of eggs drops in Bitcoin, and that it actually costs less now in Bitcoin to buy the same dozen of eggs. So it was the own on the Fed's part, but it did demonstrate these two divergent trends, also establishing or helping to establish why, as a business owner, you should start to be thinking, again, I'm not saying price things in Bitcoin to your customers, but thinking about, as you're contemplating changing dollar prices, to use Bitcoin as that lighthouse, as that anchor to say, am I increasing the cost of my good in nominal terms and real terms, or am I just accounting for the fact that they've printed more money? And the way to do that is to say, you know, and I'll use a hard example, which is our local rancher, $8 of eggs going to $8.75. And that $8 price was the case from 2021 to 2023. And then just a few months ago was increased to $8.75, which is a 9% dollar price increase. But if you look at it, over any of those 3 years in between, the current price of eggs in Bitcoin terms is less. So he increased his price in nominal terms, in dollar terms, but he didn't increase his prices in real Bitcoin terms. And if his business is catered increasingly to people that have Bitcoin, then that's what ultimately matters to them. And any business owner that is trying to sustain themselves can accept that dollar price increases are inevitable because they're making a lot more dollars. But if you're not able to consistently maintain or reduce your price in Bitcoin terms, then whatever dollar price you're reflecting is probably going to impair your business more than it otherwise should. And again, it's not to say start pricing your things in Bitcoin. It's that start being aware of your dollar price increases and thinking of them relative to the change in the price of your good in Bitcoin terms over time as this barometer, this kind of check and balance to see whether or not you're actually becoming more effective in the hard money term, which over time becomes the more important arbiter. And then my perspective is people should actually lean into it, because in certain cases, price increases in dollar world are inevitable. And just as, you know, I might get out on Twitter and talk about how, yeah, hey, this good or service just increased this amount, is to start leaning into it and saying, yes, we have to increase our prices because they're making a lot more dollars. Our inputs are going up in dollar terms because there's more dollars floating around competing for the same number of goods and services, but we didn't increase our prices in Bitcoin terms. We encourage you to pay us in Bitcoin, and you know we'll continue to be transparent about why we're increasing prices. But the more you can help us of paying us in the form of money that can't be debased will allow us to, in real terms, actually reduce prices over time, because that is ultimately what we think matters most to our ability to continue to deliver this service. Again, I'm not saying that someone's going to hear that and immediately be like, yes, I'm going to do that tomorrow. But fundamentally, that is the right logical way to think about it. And it ultimately becomes the recipe of survival and success for a business owner, and the way that they start to shift over to a Bitcoin standard, not just accepting it, not just saving it on their balance sheet, but thinking about the relationship between this kind of waterbed that's existing of dollar prices constantly changing and the impact that has on their business, and making sure that they can always look to the anchor, the thing that's not changing, Bitcoin, and say, am I raising my price in Bitcoin terms? Because that would not make sense, because they haven't been printing Bitcoin, and then looking at that over time. And that becomes one way that over time you slowly start to normalize into ultimately a Bitcoin standard and Bitcoin prices.
Yeah. And we've been spitballing ideas around that, because there has to be some sort of like trailing index on this, because just Bitcoin's price volatility. Like if you, let's just say you increase, let's say we have a similar cycle, the cycle's passed, we have a blow off top next December, and you increase prices that month, and then you increase them 6 months later and Bitcoin's gone down like 30%, whatever it may be. Technically that would be like an increase in Bitcoin prices. So that we've been trying to figure out like what is the index or the trailing time period at which you track this.
Right. And I think that, you know, reality is you do it, like Bitcoin is still volatile. But the question is, if you were increasing, and this is the other side of the equation of like, if I was a business owner, how I'd be thinking about this. If I'm increasing my prices every 6 months, like I've got a real problem. And that's just reality. And part of this discussion or this line is accepting this fact that dollar inflation is this vicious cycle, and there is no easy solution to it. There's no silver bullet of saying, I'm just going to opt out and I'm on Bitcoin now and that's it. It's like, no, that's not the way the real world works. If I'm a local ranch, if I'm a local grocer, if I'm a dentist, whatever I'm doing, I have, you know, maybe 1% of the world understands Bitcoin. I've got costs that are dollar denominated. I've got more dollars competing against an existing pool of resources. That's just a reality. But I can either be lower agency and not take marginal steps to move off of that problem, or I can be higher agency and take those marginal steps. And so thinking about it and saying, hey, like in the local rancher's case where I was showing this example, I looked at it as a 2-year average and looked at it compared to 2021, 2022, 2023, saying like, okay, like, you know, is this generally in line? It's like, it's a best effort. It's not, I mean, maybe I have to, but I'm at least paying attention to this and being aware of it while I'm doing it. And if you're looking at something over an average, then you're taking into account volatility. But the other half of how you solve this is if you were saving in Bitcoin, your balance sheet, over time, and again, there's no quick solution to this, but if you are progressively saving in Bitcoin, that balance sheet is what is paying and helping bear the brunt of dollar price increases. Because if you were thinking about passing price increases onto your customer, but then thinking about them in relation to Bitcoin, if you've been saving in Bitcoin for a year, maybe Bitcoin's gone down over that year, but if it's 2 years, if it's 3 years, you increasingly become, you know, in the green or in the black to say like, okay, I've stored purchasing power. My inputs are actually cheaper now because I've saved in Bitcoin. And when my supplier increases my price, I can look at it and say, do I want to pass that increase on to the customer? Or, you know what? I've saved in Bitcoin for this reason. I'm going to choose to defer the price increase to gain a competitive advantage against my customer, because I can still buy the same amount
against your competitor. Yeah.
Of product.
Yeah.
Now, marginal profit is always important, and you're not going to want to be running any activity at a loss. But by having your balance sheet saved in Bitcoin and thinking about, like, you know, one way that I relate it to business owners is thinking about each gross profit unit and saying, you get the gross profit unit, and then from that point forward, it's degraded and degraded and degraded. Imagine if each of those gross profit units marginally, not 100% all at once, was converted into Bitcoin. Because also, when people are accepting Bitcoin payments, it doesn't magically just show up that 100% of their business is getting paid in Bitcoin. It's 2%, 3%, 5%.
For us, it's like 20%.
Yeah, right. And so that might become what you are just able to save and put away. But then over time, as you need to pay your employees more, well, you have the Bitcoin and it's offset the dollar inflation. So, you know, you're good. And part of the impact of that, those dollar price increases, is blunted by your balance sheet. And so by looking at this collectively, it's like, okay, we can't just magically solve this vicious cycle of dollar inflation. The only way out is through the storm. And I have to start thinking about both how I pass on dollar price increases to my customers, as well as how I manage price increases from my suppliers or my inputs with this tool, and looking at it collectively on both, you know, being conscious of Bitcoin denominated, or I'd say real terms, as well as nominal, and then also how you manage your balance sheet is the only way to actually solve a problem.
Yeah. No, I admire and really value your, not only your, I don't want to call it zealotry, but your passion for this particular problem and solving. Because you really hooked onto this problem like 2 years ago when inflation like hit 9-10%. And I remember having conversations with you. You were not panicked, but like, we need to go to a gas station, figure out how to get them to accept Bitcoin. We need to go, our beef initiative was blowing up. It's like, good, we're getting the ranchers figured out. But there is this urgency, I would argue, there certainly should be some urgency to get everything that we've been discussing into motion as quickly as possible, because we have been in this period where the rate of inflation's come down. That's lulled,
I mean,
a lot of people into a false sense of security.
What I would say is certain things have started to come down in price. Food has not, and anything generally marginal service-wise has not. Like, fuel has, but again, we've massively depleted our strategic reserves. That's the functionally on a marginal basis, like printing oil or gas. And so there's just this fundamental reality that as the fiat system deteriorates, it doesn't get less expensive in fiat terms to deliver goods. Like, it becomes more and more efficient with sound money to deliver services cheaper and cheaper. That problem does not magically get better. And we are setting up for this next point of, they're lowering interest rates and they are about to print a shit ton of money. This problem is not, you know, it's like kind of, if you're in the eye of the storm, maybe that's the right analogy. And it's not to panic, but it's to operate with urgency and intentionality about there's a problem. It's clear, it's present. We can be higher agency and go, you know, figure out how to put one foot in front of the other and actually advance towards solving a problem. Or we can sit back and, you know, hope and change the strategy. And that, you know, I do, you know, like, we've literally lived in a world in 2020 where, and again, it was a government-led shutdown, but the beef at the grocery store stopped showing up. The solution to that problem was, like, go shake a rancher's hand and make sure that you have a relationship with that guy, and so that that guy keeps putting food on your plate and you have a direct relationship. You reduce the risk. But just thinking about that problem as a microcosm to everything, it is that businesses fail because of inflation. More businesses fail as inflation worsens because they're constantly having to spend more of their time looking at this, understanding how they're backwards and that they need to increase prices, and then they impair their business by pricing certain customers out. And so if you accept this premise, which is that it makes businesses harder to run with inflation, it's not just, you know, the academic economist saying, well, you know, or the person sitting there saying, I'm just going to store my value in Bitcoin and not spend my dollar, saying, okay, well, if I look at that business and I show up tomorrow and it's now charging me 5% more, and then I show up in 6 months and it's charging me another 7% more, that is the business basically trying to get ahead of a problem, and that it doesn't fix itself. The only way that problem is fixed is by saying, you start accepting Bitcoin, you can stop, you know, in the future, at some future date, stop increasing your prices for the reason that you have money that's not getting debased over time. You know, like, that's the only way out. And so just the more people that focus in on, like, that problem's not getting solved, period, unless you have higher agency. And the people that are the almost by definition highest of agency are Bitcoiners and people that run businesses, and then the overlap of people that run businesses that are Bitcoiners. They're the ones that will say, like, I'm not going to just sit in this fucking house as it burns. I'm going to go, you know, turn on my business, say, you can pay me in Bitcoin. And as more Bitcoiners exist, more people will see that very logical path.
Yeah. And I think it's important too. Obviously, there's a lot of anticipation for this presidential election. It does seem like it's trending in the direction that many of us wanted to go in, which is away from the incumbent administration towards what I would deem to be more sane administration. But I also think as people are becoming more confident that Trump is going to get back in office, there is a level of complacency because he's out there talking big game. We're going to drive down energy prices. I'm going to solve inflation. But the structural issues that exist in the U.S., there's too much debt, not enough dollars, still persist. And there's not many levers he can pull outside of a complete decimation of the administrative class and the federal government that would actually quell the problem or solve the problem in any material way. And I find it hard to believe that is going to happen easily, if at all. And so just trying to get to the point, like, despite the fact that it seems like a more sane administration may be coming into power as we head into 2025, this inflation problem is still external to that.
I would say it's foundational. And so that's one of the things that there can be certain policies that are marginally better and beneficial to worse policies, and those should be pursued, right? If it makes sense to incentivize building manufacturing in the United States rather than allowing companies to literally hop across the border, not be subject to the same costs, and then pop them back over, but maybe that's a good policy. Like, I probably agree with that. Until people talk about the fact that the printing of money is the source, and I understand the two things relate to each other. The government wants to spend a lot of money and the Fed finances it out of thin air because the two people are in bed together. But if you didn't have the ability, the forcing function is taking away the ability to print money. Fed's never going away on its own. Only way to solve it is Bitcoin. And my view is that until people start to talk about the money printing as the problem, then they might be very well intentioned about solving other economic issues. They're never going to solve the problem of inflation for the reason they're not talking about the right thing. But then also, and what you mentioned is something that I talk about a lot, graduate than suddenly, which is there's just a structural imbalance between the amount of debt in the system and the amount of actual dollars. And that is what dictates that almost regardless of what even the government does at this standpoint, they're going to have to print more money. otherwise that entire system collapses, and it's the printing of money that actually defers the collapse. And that, in my view, is the causal relationship that dictates why more and more money will be printed mathematically. And that, yeah, I saw a clip from what's the Thomas Massey. And he had this cup of iced tea. And he said, "Let me show you what happens when you print a bunch more money." And he took a jug of water and he poured it into the tea. He's like, "This is dilution." It's like, "This is what happens when you print money." Again, Thomas Massey's talking about it. Yeah. I don't think that, at least at a congressional level, even though he's read the Bitcoin Standard and talked about it on a podcast, he's not talking about Bitcoin as part of the solution in front of Congress. Obviously, Cynthia Lummis is, or Senator Lummis. But yeah, so I think that, yeah, there's just this structural imbalance. And in on one part, I talk about it being debt to dollars. On the other part, it's like when you think about the economic imbalance, it is that, and this is what also drives hyperinflation, you have certain people that have more dollars than they could ever need. And you have this whole other swath, probably the majority of people, that don't have a role in the economy to be able to sustain themselves. And they have no savings. And economic imbalance just gets worse and worse in this world. And then you have people that have way more dollars that are just ejecting out of them because they don't need them ever to actually facilitate the things they need in their daily lives. While at the same time, you have people that have nothing. And balance is ultimately what you're striving for. And balance does not mean equality. Balance means a way for an economic system to constantly find balance through trade, by delivering mutual value. And so ultimately it's better than worse if somebody who respects the Constitution and doesn't, you know, go after their political rivals like the, you know, Democrats have of Trump, and somebody that actually has a perspective on an economic policy that will be more sustaining rather than exporting all of our manufacturing to other countries and then having them ship back in and paying for it basically via the printing of money, to be there, like that is better than the alternative, but it doesn't get solved. Like the problem of inflation, everything that we're talking about, like there's no way out of this vicious cycle. The dollar can't fix itself. It's too far gone. It's too far broken. And it only becomes more, you know, fractured over time. The imbalance only gets greater as a function of time. That doesn't mean that something doesn't correct slowly over 3 months and then gets worse over the next year. But it's a functionally a one-way directional trend. And that's why, again, I'm actually very optimistic. It's just like, hey, the way that you become optimistic is by actually taking the forward steps to permanently solve the problem. And that's where it comes back to, if you're a business and you're not taking that forward action, you know that inflation is causing your business havoc. You're if you didn't constantly, and Bitcoin's not going to solve this in the short term, but if you're not constantly having to think about raising prices just for the fact that you know that they're printing money and that you have your employees that are constantly asking you for raises because their cost is getting more, like, you know that inflation is causing you a problem and there's only one solution, and it's Bitcoin. And if you're not taking every possible advantage to solve that problem, you're just, you know, dead in the water.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think, and it's very apparent to anybody who's listening to this podcast, I much prefer Trump and hope that he gets into office. But I do think he has been making a strategic misstep in choreographing or attempting to choreograph that he's going to bring down prices. Because I think structural issues that you just described, it's impossible. And that's my hope, is that he does develop the intestinal fortitude and understanding to actually call out the problem. He's going in the opposite direction, saying the dollar is the best.
Well, and he's launching a shitcoin.
And he's launching a shitcoin. But that, I mean, again, strategic misstep in the sense that there's a very, not only a possibility, but a high likelihood that he does get into office. We have an economic crisis. We have to print a shit ton of money, and inflation goes back to where it was a couple of years ago. We have a repeat in the 1970s echo inflation. And I would hope that he has surrounded himself with advisors and people within his administration that are capable enough to recognize and have, again, the intestinal fortitude to basically say it publicly, because that's the big problem. It's like the elephant in the room that you're not allowed to point at and acknowledge, is that the dollar is a problem. the fiat system is a problem. And until that is recognized, you can't, at least at the federal level, what we're describing here is how to save yourself at the individual small business level. But this problem has layers going all the way up to the top layer of the federal government. And until it is officially acknowledged and confronted head on, which I think Senator Lummis with the Bitcoin Act is trying to do, but I think we need more momentum in that realm.
Look, I think that clearly Trump doesn't get it. He's at least figured out why politically he needs to align himself. And so that's at least an improvement, right? Like,
take what we can get.
Take what we can get. I also believe that there are people around him who are much closer to actually getting it. Just from hearing people, or choosing one person as an example, Vivek Ramaswamy. I think that he's starting to clearly understand it. Same with RFK. Like, RFK's speech at the Bitcoin conference was phenomenal. And there's still the possibility that he didn't fully get it. You know, he went and talked at the shitcoin conference, but the way that he spoke about it, it's like, do you accept that knowledge distributes over time, more people understand Bitcoin, not less, that the way that RFK Jr. talked about Bitcoin from the 2023 conference to the 2024 conference, markedly different, you know? And so there are increasingly people around that aren't just sympathetic to it, but I think are increasingly grokking it. And that will be beneficial, because I agree that there's this economic tsunami coming and they're going to have to bring a shit ton more money. That's going to make the problems worse. And having people that are seeing this field and recognizing that this is the only way out and that there's going to have to be some pain to be felt is not dystopian. It's not, you know, not optimistic. It's actually just
pragmatic
and saying, the way that I can actually solve this problem and be optimistic and be okay with tolerating pain is by knowing that I have a path out on the other side. Well, if you're not actually keying in on the medium that's actually causing it, then it's a lot harder to be optimistic or to be able to sustain and to, you know, weather that storm. One of the things I increasingly appreciate about Nayib Bukele, you know, when he spoke at CPAC, not only did he explain, you know, why do they tax you?
The humiliation ritual.
Humiliation ritual, in a very succinct way of saying, like, they don't tax you to fund the government. They tax you to give the illusion that you fund the government, because that allows them to continue to print money. And that when the currency fails, when the charade fails, like, there's going to be a lot of pain. Like, he's at least honest about that. He's taking a forward action to protect their local economy and advance their local economy. There's going to be an impact to their local economy. And the way that he speaks about it is saying, like, there's unavoidable pain to come. Like, that is unavoidable. And while he might not say this next part, is like, he understands why. And in certain cases, he certainly connects it to the money, but he doesn't talk about it in a negative sense. He just talks about it in a realistic sense and saying, If we're not being honest, and we don't have any realistic chance of finding our way through this storm or actually coming out the other side stronger. And, you know, basically saying, like, the more you accept on the front end, the more easily you're going to be able to move forward in a effective way.
Yeah. How should we leave it with the freaks? What call to action should we set out there?
I would just say,
this was powerful. This is the best rip we've done in a few years, I think.
We say that every time.
I know, and it only gets better, freaks.
It only gets better. I thought the last one we did was pretty good, though. Bitcoin and not the American dream, but nothing more American than Bitcoin. Yeah. That was pretty good.
No, but in terms of, like, actual, like, I think this is, I mean, you're preaching to the choir with me, but we've been talking about this a lot over the last 2 years, and more specifically over the last 3 weeks, because I do feel that urgency again to really secure at least the businesses that I'm dependent on to receive goods and services, because you can feel it coming back. Like, the 9% increase in Sure Tale. Like, that's where we get our eggs. Like, holy shit, it's happening again. Despite the fact they're saying that inflation's dropping, the rate of inflation is dropping. But I do hope, and I can't imagine that people listening to this do feel inspired to act and go out there and seriously think about solving this problem.
Yeah, so I'd say, one, if you haven't read the article, go read the article. Bitcoin's Exchange Theory of Value. That's on my blog, graduatethansuddenly.xyz. Except, hopefully, logically, once you've read that, that Bitcoin actually increases in value as it's able to facilitate more exchange, and that the medium Bitcoin and you know, value period is created through trade. And to not sit there and just stare at your Bitcoin on the screen and thinking, like, I'm going to be okay because this inanimate object on my screen is going to create value on its own. And if I just sit here for long enough that it will, it's that, you know, to be high agency, particularly if you run a business, to say, I accept that I have this problem. I've already found Bitcoin for the reason that I've accepted this problem, and I shouldn't stop there. I should actually work progressively, if even incrementally or marginally, to cut the problem out at its knees, one step at a time, one day at a time. And if you're in the position to do so, and generally businesses that are privately owned, one or two key decision makers, or somebody understanding Bitcoin, they're the ones that are in the position to lead, to say, yeah, the rails exist, they're workable. You know, are they going to get better over time? Are they going to get more, are they going to get more and more seamless? You know, is friction increasingly going to be taken out of them? Of course, but they're in a position right now to accept them. And if I don't, you know, if not me, then who? And to take that action, then the customers will show up, you know, if you leverage it. So, and then for the rest of the Bitcoiners out there accepting that, you know, just that idea that you know, there's no moral imperative to go out there and spend your Bitcoin. That's not the message that I'm carrying. It's that, while there's no, you know, you don't need to go spend your Bitcoin for it to create value. If no one does, if no one is high agency, then yes, we have a problem. And that when you actually go, if I think about going and spending, you know, a small percent of my Bitcoin with Cole's stake, it's like I'm spending like 0.0001% of my Bitcoin. And it's like, I'm saving everything else. And by having the foresight to say, I can't just sit in the house while it burns, I gotta go solve my problems. And I can do that by helping to not only educate people on why this is important, but putting them in a position to accept that, you know, that they can adopt the tools if they want to in a very accessible way. More people that do that, then less better we're going to be. So, you know, each day is a day to take ground, and more ground is taken by more business owners saying that they want to accept Bitcoin as payment. So,
since you're too much of a gentleman and too humble, I will give the shill for Zaprite. It is the perfect tool to begin accepting these payments, particularly because you have both fiat and Bitcoin payments in parallel. And I like the way, I forget who described it to John, but we were talking about this at over beers a few weeks ago. Is like, you have this Venn diagram of people that accept fiat and people that will accept Bitcoin in the future, and the circles are beginning to blend, and the small intersection in the middle is getting bigger and bigger. And Zaprite is the perfect tool to facilitate your business, your accepting of money generally, whether it's Bitcoin or fiat, as those circles converge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't intentionally leave out Zaprite, but I do think, you know, and again, my message is broader than that. Like, there's a lot of great companies building a lot of great tools. You know, one thing I didn't mention, you know, it's like, there's a lot of different, there's business owners, there's consumers, there's people building in the Bitcoin community and financing and accepting that, like, hey, like, this is an aspect of Bitcoin that's actually critical to its proliferation as money. The more we can do to affect and perfect it as money, the more valuable everything in the Bitcoin ecosystem becomes. But yeah, at Zaprite, you know, It's not just that we accept Bitcoin in dollars. It's a huge benefit of it. It's like we recognize that on-chain payments are just as important as Lightning. We have an API where people can manage. It's one of the popular use cases of Zaprite, and anybody who has development resources that is in Bitcoin, being able to manage one API where they can facilitate all of their Bitcoin and fiat payments is incredibly powerful. So anybody that could potentially be interested in our API, reach out to me. And yeah, you know, we support people like local dentists to, you know, highly technical, large businesses. So
yeah, like TFTC.
Yeah, exactly.
We're still, as I say, we're highly technical, big business. We have camera issues.
Media mogul, media empire.
Media empire.
What we're going to need to do though is save the ranchers, let the ranchers save the world, you know, focus on our, you know, things that we can control in our media environment. And one by one,
we're going to win. Peace and love, freaks.